Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Irish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Meg Smith, one of the channel's hosts, and today I'll be talking to Stephen Hewer about his new book, Beyond Exclusion in Medieval Ireland, Intersections of Ethnicity, Sex, and Society Under English Law, published just this year by Breppels. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we dig into the book, Stephen, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah, I'm currently a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow at Liverpool, University of Liverpool's Institute of Irish Studies. Before that, I was a Fonds Wippenschappelijk Onderzoek Vlaanderen postdoctoral onderzoeker at Ghent University in Belgium and an Irish Research Council postdoctoral fellow at Trinity College Dublin. My research is on sociolegal status of minorities, and by minorities, I mean people who are experiencing colonization, immigrants, women in high medieval Northwest Europe. This research has led me into studying colonial and sexist discourse employed by other scholars in the past and still today when describing so-called medieval Europe. And, you know, if people want to learn more, I have my full CV and publications on my personal website, stephenhewer.com. I have my scholarly articles and public engagement works up there, so it's very easy to access for anyone. Except my most recent journal article, it's under embargo for 6 months.
Great, thanks. That's obviously a very pressing area of study. So how did you come to this project in particular? What was kind of the driving question behind the book?
The book is a reworked, restructured take on my PhD thesis. And the reworking I did on my own, just sort of to balance the chapters out, I felt there was sort of a sex gender issue with how the thesis was. And I said, I can fix this. And that's sort of how you get the discrimination chapter, which we can come to later, was I took those were separately into men and women. I said, let's put these all together to really highlight its women experience it more. We'll get into that later. And I cut some material that you normally would find in a thesis, but not in a book, my analysis of my main sources. And I came to the project just to publish the main findings from the thesis and to have an academic book. So I should probably mention here that publication part of the book process, the peer review and all the waiting for peer review and the edits and the copy editing was funded postdoctoral project. I just mentioned the IRC, Research Council, Irish Research Council. And that job gave me great opportunities to put my work around Europe right before the pandemic hit. So thanks, IRC. And the driving question behind the book is how were minorities, like I said, referring to ethnicities in the book. I've later come to not like that term, and sex gender. Those people being not English, who was the colonial culture identity in this context, and all women, including English women, were treated socially and legally in medieval English Ireland, my shorthand for the various English colonies in Ireland. Now, obviously, it's not exhausted, for one, did not include people from the European subcontinent, such as Lucans, Florentines, of which there were many in Ireland at that time, or from the rest of the world, which there are very few records of. So these cultural groups, I call ethnicities in the books, it's not perfect. There's the Irish, and the two main groups of Irish are the Gaels and the Aust people, and then groups that include people born in Ireland, sometimes for several generations, three or four or five, and immigrants who all fall under a sort of socio-legal construct of Welsh, Scottish, and then I've got Manx and Hebrideans in there as well. Now, these latter groups, I call the Irish Sea region ethnicities. And I should note, Scottish is not really ethnicity. It's an inclusive identity made up of several groups we might call ethnicities. And that's why I'm trying to move away from the term ethnicity for future writing. And these are the most numerous groups. So that's how they all got included, much more numerous than the Lucans and Laurentines. And also these groups encountered questions and complaints concerning their access to the English colonial courts in Ireland and their ability to hold lands in fee. So the other main reason the book is not exhaustive to pivot here is the focus is on 1250 to 1320. And that's due to surviving records, but also include a few exceptional records. So early as 1190 and the latest 1381. The surviving records that I use are mostly court rolls, because that is the most likely place for you to find regular medieval people. I did also use some financial records and charters. And I'm mentioning surviving several times because some may know, you might know, it's 30th of June, 1922, the record treasury at the four courts in Dublin blew up. 700 years of records are lost. The record treasury had been seized by the IRA during the Civil War, and they were still storing their gelignite in there. And some call it an unfortunate fire. The fire came after the gelignite explosion. I think we should always try and not forget that part. So due to this explosion of gelignite, the surviving records are mostly transcripts and calendars of the medieval records. The important difference being transcript maintain the original language, usually Latin, and but they might be in a different script, while a calendar is an abbreviated translation in modern type. So the majority of the transcripts of court records were made by the Record Commission in 1819 to 1824. And so I plan to publish sort of a history prosopography of the Record Commission. I think it was very interesting, and just sort of COVID's gotten in the way and finishing the book edits and moving countries, Belgium and Ireland and Belgium and all that. It's gotten in the way, so that's been put on hold, and then hopefully I can get back to it. And then the other main series is from about 1901. There's a series of calendars were made by the employees of the Public Record Office of Ireland. And these are all calendars. Like I said, they're English translations, and they're abbreviated. Details are taken out. So most of the court records are not published, while the exchequer records, financial records, were published as part of just the annual report back to the UK government. So those are much easier to access if anyone's interested in financial records. They're the deputy keeper reports, the annual deputy keeper reports for the state papers of Ireland. Now, some scholars have praised these calendars being more complete than the transcripts from the Record Commission. The PROI staff made some questionable translations, which we can now not question at all because the originals are destroyed. And since they're only an English translation, we don't know what the original word is. And sometimes we just try and undo the English translation to get back to what was the Latin term, which reading the book, you know, I do like to point out something that's very important. What was the Latin term used? So, back to the book, looking mostly 1250 to 1320, I searched for non-English people and English women using the royal courts, which is irrefutable proof of free status. This conclusion was previously that Gaelic people could have been personally free but did not have access to the courts. I found a few possible examples of this, and I labeled that unaccepted to distinguish unfree people from free people without access to the royal courts. Now, contemporary legal experts, contemporary being medieval, and the English courts in their judgments used the term free to designate people who did have access to the royal courts, especially in Ireland. And this is why we need to be careful here. And that's why I'm using unaccepted for free but unfranchised people. And I think I use that in the book, free but unfranchised. That is important to differentiate from unfree and free and franchised. So there's at least three broad groups we're looking at there. Now, it's not a book's not a traditional legal history. It's a social history relying on legal records. So I'm also looking at charters to and from non-English people and English women, showing us the arguments that these groups could not hold free lands in fee are not true, because one could not grant away lands that one did not hold in fee in the first place. So the book does not only explore that, but it is one of the main takeaways. And hopefully I haven't gone into too much detail for later questions in my broad summary.
No, not at all. I find these discussions of both the source bases, but also the entanglements between the medieval and the modern. Really fascinating. And of course, that goes to show how modern historiography has shaped our understandings, both of these medieval legal records, but also of the sort of broader society that they speak to. And so one of the things that I found really valuable in this book is kind of rolling back all of those centuries of scholarship and starting from the records themselves and trying to sort of move forward. And of course, doing that, as you say, is very complicated because of all of the various layers of surrogacy that we have in those records. I want to dig into this question of translations and word choices, though, because you give so much thoughtful consideration to how those questions of vocabulary shape our assumptions and our interpretations of these historical actors. So could you talk a little bit more about how you approached choosing translations, choosing vocabulary for these people and these statuses?
Yeah, absolutely. I spent a great deal of time reading through some of the greatest theories for me. Studying a colonial situation, most scholars of medieval Ireland agree the English colonized large part of the island of Ireland, but they don't seem to engage with post-colonial, decolonial works and lenses. And my biggest influences are Said, Crenshaw, Spivak, Baba, and a bit of Foucault and Derrida. Now, the first thing to note is as many scholars of medieval Ireland love to use the term native, which I'm only going to say here once, just so everyone knows which N-word I'm referring to. Here in a medieval context, from reading these theorists, it's important to take a look at what's the context of this term. So in the medieval context, it means a legally and socially labeled born unfree, from the Latin, born unfree person. And in a modern context, is a term of colonial violence employed by European colonists to dehumanize people in what's now called North and South America, India, Africa, etc. And so to repeat the N-word while studying medieval English colonization is to repeat and reify the colonial violence and mindset. So there is no context where some scholar can take this term and deploy it to describe the Gaelic people in medieval Ireland without supporting a colonial perspective. Also in the book I mentioned, previous scholars used the term to argue that all Gaels were considered legally unfree, not just unaccepted like I mentioned earlier, but unfree, by the English colonists in Ireland and their courts. And so while I did find a few naifs, which is perhaps a better translation for nativa and nativus, which most scholars just say nativus, when there was women, where were the women? Then the N-word for nativa, nativus, it's maybe used naif. But most Gaels who appear in the surviving court records were not considered a nativa or nativus. So, I mean, they're in the royal courts, and to be able to use it is to be free.
Thanks. And like I said, I think this is a really important discussion for, as you say, sort of the contemporary violence that those terms do, but also to how they sort of unconsciously shape our assumptions because, of course, yes, these are specific legal terms that have sort of been lost as we've broadened the scope of that vocabulary. So I was struck as I read through the early chapters of the book by the range of participation by free Gaelic men in the courts. So as you say, we see already early on that you are challenging this question of, I guess, limitations to access to the courts. And as you show us, we see Gaelic men in the courts as plaintiffs, as defendants, as jurors and attorneys, as pledges and warranters, and all kinds of other roles that they're playing in these negotiations. And so that also maybe challenges some longstanding assumptions about access to the courts. Does it also complicate our understanding of society at large in this period?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely complicating everything. I think we just need to erase the whole binary construct in the first place so that we can get down and dive into it's just complicated. So, most of our understanding comes from secondary sources. And I think you mentioned earlier, whatever reason, fear, critiquing a senior scholar, uninterest in that specific topic, admiration for the established narrative. 99% of the secondary sources agree that there was a universal discrimination against the Gaelic Irish. And that there was this binary of free English and unfree Irish. And like I said earlier, I'm searching through the surviving records for similar clues, such as the ones I found uncover this situation of free Gaelic men, and not just free in that they weren't knaves. They're holding positions of power. There's some that are lords over English tenants. They have English tenants under them in the feudal pyramid, which I know some people don't like feudal, but you know, we got to be wary of absolutes. I tell students all the time, always be suspicious if someone says always or never, and then I wait for them to catch that I just said always.
So we see this, like I said, an enormous range of roles that Gaelic men are playing in the courts. We also then see a lot of women in the courts, and I was really intrigued by this tension between the legal principles and the practices in the case of women in the courts, right? We see this great diversity of legal strategies employed by women, often successfully, despite a lack of codified legal rights. So how did you go about evaluating which of those cases were exceptional and which might reveal more widespread practices?
Well, this is even more complicated than the free Gaelic men, because now we're getting into even more wider than just outside, just Ireland, but outside of Ireland, medieval Europe, historiography of sort of this idea of coverture. Now there was, I did later find some instances of clear coverture. This noble English woman is married, her case must be thrown out, yada, yada. So, but let's go back first to, you know, legal theorists would point out medieval English women did have some codified rights. We just, as 21st century feminists, would not consider these fair or just or equal, but they were codified and they were rights to contemporary legal minds, medieval contemporary minds. These were rights, and that they're using the term use. And I'll immediately follow that. My own, in the book and all my research, as I rely on law and practice methodology, which means codified rights mean absolutely nothing when powerful can easily dismiss, ignore, or literally delete those rights in a codified sense, or not even in a codified sense, just in a single case judgment. If the justice, or today a judge, says, no, you had rights, but I don't think you deserve rights, bangs the gavel, your codified rights mean nothing, do they? You're now going to jail or being fined or whatever. So, yeah. Legislation, codification of law is good for a mental exercise, but I'm looking at people's rights, your human rights. Law and practice, that was all that matters for human rights. So
in some ways, it's not even attention at all then, right? So it's really about the practice.
Yeah. So there is a tension within this system, the English law, colonial law in Ireland. There is a tension between what they think the law should be. Everyone has, go back to legal theorists, the law in mind. And every juror and every justice has an idea of what the law should be. But then this particular case comes along and they go, well, no woman should have rights, but I will make an exception because this woman actually, no, she does deserve rights. But this is an exception. But yeah, now we're getting off the ifs and it's getting away from law and practice. But I will go back to your point, there are more cases, dozens of books could be written just about women in 13th century Ireland, Gaelic Ireland, English Ireland. And I do hope to read those one day, because mine are, you know, instances in here are just related to the theme of the book, which is intersections of women, sex, gender with ethnicity. And so I did have to do English women to show the differences between English men and English women, and English women and Gaelic women and Ost women, who had never really been mentioned. The word, I invented that word, it never, they were just Ost men. There were no Ost women. It's amazing how they existed. But there are so many more cases. If you look at just at a sex gender aspect, there were so many more I couldn't include because the editors said, no, you can't have a 500 page book. So I'd love to read five more books about women in 13th century Ireland and comparing instances between the Gaelic, the Finicus is what it's called. People today call it Brehon law. This is another historiographical versus medieval issue, but Finicus versus the English colonial system, and how was different experiences. And Crenshaw is really important here. That's, I mean, intersectionality is in the title of the book, not just the chapter on women. And it's huge here to remember the intersectional ways we're dealing with. Even a noble English woman could have no choice in her husband. Then she comes into court and says, I want to hang this criminal because he committed a crime on my lands. And the court says, yes, that's true. You can't pick your husband and you can't sue without him, but you can hang this man. I will also say, I almost forgot, there's women attorneys and matronymic surnames, which are two things I try to highlight in the book. And I think listeners should definitely know about these things because you don't hear about them, especially like the history of women in medieval Ireland. They don't talk about, there were women attorneys. They came into court and they spoke as an attorney. I am here. Half of them represented their husband, but others didn't. They represented other people, women attorneys. Matronymic is obviously like a patronym. And I found a very interesting case was there was William Fitz Egidia Jr. And his mother's in the same case, Egidia de Staunton. So she's got a surname. So his father isn't good enough to name William after, but also he's not William de Staunton. He's William Fitz Egidia. And the junior's even more mind-boggling because who was William Fitz Egidia Sr.? His older brother who had died. And so she's like, well, son number two will just be William Jr. You know, could it possibly have been his father was also William Fitz Egidia and Egidia de Staunton married William Fitz Egidia Sr.? This is to me as the question I really love someone to come along. I've got the answer. I'd love to hear that.
There are so many tantalizing little potential distractions, I guess, but also, you know, stories that deserve a lot of treatment in their own right. So women attorneys, women collectors of revenues, there are all these little dimensions that I desperately want books on. So I agree. I would love for someone to come along and write all of these and to pick up all of these threads that you've left and links to it, what is obviously very rich source material. So I think that's another one of the book's great achievements, actually, is just to sort of reveal this enormously rich tapestry that we sometimes forget about because we just sort of assume that all the records are gone.
They're not. There's so many records mm-hmm. left. I've got so many other anecdotes I could just about women I could say. It is definitely, I hope people read the book and go, I could write my whole second book with this as a source material because it's not a political narrative. And people go, it's a history book. Oh, it'll be a political narrative talking about the day Edward I of England was born and until the day he died. No, I hate those. I want you to pick up my book and go, I could write my own bachelor's and master's thesis and dissertation just with this. And I don't have to fly to Ireland and from wherever you are in the world. Oh no, we've got a source here. And that's another thing I hope it does is people go, oh, wow, look at all these cases and let's flesh them out and look at more cases to add in.
Absolutely. So in those first couple of chapters, you do lay out all of these different dimensions of participation in the courts. But midway through the study period, we do start to see these increasing challenges to the legal status of Gaelic people on the basis of ethnicity. And it's kind of curious because often those challenges are unsuccessful, but it does seem like they're increasing in frequency. And so this presents another kind of intriguing tension. What do we make of this?
That's another central, I mean, it's going back to the central theme of the book is going, okay, previous scholars have mentioned this. I mean, it's not made up. This was medieval words that were recorded in a record. The problem is when they said the English law on Ireland was that only five bloods was the medieval term of Gaelic nobles could use the English royal courts in Ireland. That was a defensive plea that was used three times out of 200,000 court cases. Three times the defendant desperate threw out something made up and someone heard it. And so then they repeated it in their court case 2 years later. And someone else heard that, you know, a couple of years later and repeated it, but it didn't work because it was completely made up. And what's weird is that I found the first instance, it didn't even say bloods. It was lineages, progenies, the five progenies. And they're like, this is not a thing. The court said this is not a thing, but no one bothered to finish reading the court case that's only three sentences long in Latin to get to the judgment that says no. So then it's like, yeah, but I like this defensive plea. But that's law and practice, is you can't just go, well, the defendant claimed this. Sure, if you wanted to do a linguistic study and go, okay, so these five defendants all had this conspiracy that they thought if they just repeated the lie enough times, it would work. Sure, you could do that study, but you can't do a legal study and say, yes, five words was definitely codified English law. It was on the statute books. And no, it wasn't. It was completely just made up. So yeah, it is a tension that we need to just not only studying medieval history, but reading historiography, be wary. Okay, they said this. What's their source? The source is these three court cases where it was used. But then the judgments prove that no, that was not. I think that's the main thing we got to take from this.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the case of our other ethnic groups, so the Oss people, the Welsh, the Scots, all of these other groups who are also living in Ireland, and as you say, are, you know, the demarcations are maybe less clear than we want to think they are. We see new tensions as we've got political conflicts and warfare, maybe altering their legal status. But with such a small number of identifiable cases, how do we make sense of that really fragmentary evidence?
Yeah, this is the question I had to ask myself for years. Is how many cases prove a point with law and action? You can just say this one case proves the point in this one situation, and then you can move away from that. But I know people are going to say, well, more broadly, what was generally going to happen? Okay, yeah, it's not law and practice anymore, but we'll generalize. Previous scholars take one single case from 1354, I think, and where the jury says, well, yeah, sure, there are five bloods, but he's an O'Neill, which is one of the five, so he can still use the court. Aha. So in 1169, when the first English come, or 67, the first English come, they brought with them this idea of five bloods. Like, well, how did you just get back 200 years? The point is the judgment saying this plea is not true. So I'm looking at other cases around the same time, comparison for these Welsh and Scots cases, and looking for, okay, this is comparative law. We've moved away from law and practice, we're getting comparative law. So no, I've just put the cases where their actual status comes up. The Welsh is very problematic because there is the war of Welsh conquest by Edward I, and that's like one of the gaps in our sources. All those years are just a gap for court records. So we don't know if at any point Edward sent an order, probably in 1278, if this is all hypothetical, that sent an order in 1278, okay, all Welsh people will be deceased, their lands will be taken away by a royal bailiff, you know, and they'll be locked in a prison, because he did send in 1296 or 7, supposedly, an order that all Scots were to be arrested. So maybe he also said, the problem is we don't have one, so we have to guess. But the records as we currently have them, there wasn't a general record to arrest all Welsh people. And then we do have a record, it's a financial record, that there were 15, I think, Welsh mercenaries, and they had an English officer, sergeant, captain, whatever you want to call them, basically a handler. And they were paid quite well. They came over on a boat. And this guy, I think his name was John DeChester. And they came over John DeChester, and they were just, I mean, you could do a movie about this. And I think there's been a movie, not about this specifically, but basically these 15 Welsh mercenaries come over from Wales, and they're just paid to go around, to fight against Gaelic people who resisted English colonization of Ireland. And they were there for years under John DeChester, and he was paid well, and all the Welsh men were paid well to just go around and be mercenaries for the English. And so that is something you have to take into context when looking for cases of Welsh people, or what's their status. But then we also down in Waterford, the records of Welsh batas, which is, I mentioned in the beginning of the book, batas is not a legal thing, but it's only mentioned in financial records as a tenurial designator. And in England at that time, you could hold villeinage lands and be a free person. But if you're called a villein, you're a villein, which is different than a nativ, a nativus. But there's Welsh bitas, which means they're holding in batagio, which to get a bit technical here, is that they do sort of imply this is unfreedom. But could they still use the royal courts? Because they said, and now much later, about 60 years later, they said, yeah, this man is Welsh, and therefore he can use the royal courts. So we have no idea. We just have a record that they existed, Welsh bitas existed. And in every other situation, a bita can't use the royal courts, except when an Englishman is holding land. So we're getting into complicated ideas of 13th century unfreedom. How does that work? And it shifts. And like I said, the legal system, we need to look at it with law and practice, because it's dynamic, it can shift, it can move. They can just make things up, as I say in the clerics chapter, they can just make up a rule on the spot. We got to be careful with that, but hopefully I've done it now. Maybe someday some descendant of some oppressive noble kept a secret roll in a wall, and they find it, and they'll come forward and move the roll of the Welsh people of Ireland, and it'll totally disprove the 6 cases that I have. But I will
dream, honestly.
please bring forward the hidden rolls you've got in your castles, or maybe you're the descendant of a court clerk who stole a roll in 1810. Some of the missing rolls from the Records Commission. I'd love to read those. So please bring them forward.
It's definitely, though, speaks to the importance of putting these legal records within their broader social contexts, and definitely taking that holistic approach to legal history as social and political history. So transitioning then from these sort of ethnic groups into different kinds of law, I found your discussion of the relationship between ethnicity and criminal law really exciting, because along with overturning a lot of established assumptions about the legal protections or lack thereof for Gaels, you also introduce us again to some fascinating characters. And so I'd love to hear more about Geoffrey O'Farrell and maybe what his case tells us about ethnicity and criminal law.
Ah, he's a great story. And I did research him a bit more after the book was done, and I've got a History Ireland magazine article coming out hopefully later this year. It's all done. He just hasn't told me when. But Tommy, please get that out. So Geoffrey O'Farrell was the Taoiseach of Anthony, which some people call Longford. There's no Longford in 1290. So he's definitely Taoiseach of Anthony, which is a region just east of Loch Ree. He does some amazing things. First of all, he appears in the record probably as a late teenager, early 20s. He's not Taoiseach. His father's still alive, who I later found some records on his father, and that'll be in the History of Ireland article. But he shows up by he's killing English knights. And someone said, yes, killed English knights in a war, but he's brought into criminal court. And we know that this is definitely considered the crime of homicide and not war slang, because we've got royal letters saying no, this happened in war. You cannot sue someone for something that happens in war. So they thought this was, oh, these knights are not going to battle. He just caught them off guard drinking at the river and killed all of them. And there's a lot of them. There's one record that names them all, and it's a lot. So he's got basically his clientage, his followers. It's hard to translate technical Gaelic law terms here often because So basically his followers, his group, and he kills them all in 1271. But the more surprising part is that their brother, who wasn't there on the day, then sort of grants him land and becomes his attorney in court. This is just mind-blowing. It's, you killed my two younger brothers, so I'm now going to be grant you some lands and be your attorney so you don't have to physically come into court. I'll represent you in court. And does go, hey, you took cattle from my man, Geoffrey. You must give them back. And he's like, no, Geoffrey's an outlaw. No, he's not. He's not an outlaw. Give Geoffrey's cow, his cows back. He's like, this is the guy who killed your brothers. Nope. He's my man now, and I will defend him in court. And he killed some Duvernants and Theobald. But then 20 years later, he kills another English knight, John de la Mare. And William de la Mare is the son of John, grants land to Geoffrey again. He just goes around killing English lords and their relatives. Like, well, I guess I have to grant you some land now.
I wonder if that points us then to, sort of burgeoning internecine conflicts within these families.
I think it was a region that they couldn't muster an army big enough to go in and conquer him, because he clearly had his own army, if we can use a modern term for it, his followers. He had his own army, and local English settlers, colonists there, they weren't strong enough to resist him. And the Dublin, either they didn't have the money or the desire to try and muster something big enough to go in there and stop him. So for, what is it, from 1271 to 1317, he just does whatever he wants. And then a year before he dies in 1318, Mortimer shows up as the locum tenens regis, the placeholder of the King of England. And he does go with an army through there. And Geoffrey finally says, submits to peace, it says. And it doesn't say anything more, like if he had to give other cattle or anything. But he's an old man in his 60s at this point, at least. And he probably just said, yeah, I'm sorry. And Mortimer said, okay, don't do it again. You're an old man. And that's about it. Yeah. So for almost 50 years, he just ran around West Midda, Meath, in the east part of Connacht, and just did what he wanted. So yeah, he's fascinating.
He is fascinating. And does, again, kind of call into question just to what degree, I guess, the legal system privileged or did not privilege ethnic status. Your discussion of ethnicity and the legal status of clergy raises some similar questions and some equally intriguing characters. I was especially interested in Archbishop McCarville's attempts to weaponize his legal privilege to both abuse his tenants and maybe impose religious reform. What does his case tell us about the legal position of the clergy, especially the Gaelic clergy?
Yeah, the cases with clergy, especially prelates, our main conclusion we need to take from Carroll and other Gaelic prelates is that people, especially men with extreme power, should never be assumed to be benevolent, but also that a powerful man can use his power to hurt some people and help others, as McCarroll did with his friends and relatives. He's working to protect them while he's also killing English tenants on his own lands. So yeah, it's complicated. We should perhaps separate prelates from other Gaelic clergy on the lowest levels of the church, because you read they felt the need to purchase letters of protection. While the prelates, we've got the famous case of Stephen O'Brien of Cashel, 1295, he's charged with a criminal charge and he walks into the criminal court and says, I refuse to answer as my privilege as an Archbishop of Cashel. I refuse. And any other person, an English lord, the Count of Ulster himself, couldn't do that. they'd be put into a prison on the diet, which was old bread and bad water on opposite days. So you never got food or water on the same day. And he just walked in. He refused to answer the charge. So the jury reported he's completely innocent, and the court let him go. And I suspect the court had some jury tampering going on here, but I've got no proof for that. But I'd love to get some proof, because that sounds to me like I refused it. Oh, well, the jury says he's totally innocent. You don't get brought up on criminal charge just by a rumor. And the system, the English law system, is they would have to, not quite as complicated as today, but basically someone comes and they claim there's a charge, and then there's sort of not quite a grand jury. Well, sometimes there was a grand jury. So that's where the grand jury today comes from. But to get a criminal charge brought, it wasn't just you walked in and say, I'd like to have this person prosecuted for theft, please. No, it was, so he didn't get to that point where he's brought, physically forced to come into court and answer a criminal charge without them having some good evidence that it happened. But it's just like, I'm an archbishop, you can't stop me.
What a life. So over the course of the book, you describe all of these court cases and offer us some really significant conclusions about the relationship between ethnicity and legal status, and overturning and challenging some pretty longstanding scholarship. But of course, you also are giving us these really human personal moments. Is there a case that especially resonated with you? Either for speaking to the sort of big conclusions or because of those very sort of human moments?
No, there's loads that I found. It's amazing. And I'm like, how did no one come across? I wasn't the first person to look at the court rules, but just I've never read about these, because I think they're just regular people. If they're not a bishop, archbishop, or count, no one seems to care. But I find one, I'll start with one interesting example going back to women. It was Constance, the wife of Henry Galbraith. That's her only name that we've got for her. And her and Henry and a couple other people are sued. And she comes into court with Henry, and they all say they're there. And the plaintiff alleges blah, blah, blah. Constance then alone, not without Henry Galbraith, she answers. She's like, I am the tenant for this 75% of the lands. And that Peter boy over there, he can answer for his 25%. So we got other scholars speculate Constance might have actually spoken in court, but instead through an attorney on her behalf. And now, my experience of records from English Ireland usually record this if an attorney did speak instead of the actual person recorded saying they spoke. But it really doesn't matter either way, because nobles never actually, it says the Count of Ulster spoke. He didn't. He was always through. He had 17 attorneys. Legally, Constance replied as defendant and not Henry Galbraith. Or his attorney, through jus uxoris, right of the wife, she replied. She said, this is my land. I hold it. Not Henry on my behalf holds this land. Or not we. Sometimes you find married couples and they say, we hold this land when it's the wife's land. But and the husband replies for both and says, we hold this land. No, she said, I hold this land. And I think that's really, I think, very interesting, because it's upsetting the traditional jus uxoris historiographical conclusion. As others, Isabel, wife of Roger de Nilay, denial, she received a grant of a house in County Cork, sole, the term used, that is alone. Not Roger and Isabel together received it. She was granted a house. So lots of cases like that. Other cases, like Roger O'Bwellen, he sues the heirs of his infiofer. He was infiofed by an Englishman of not a huge holding, some land. But someone tried to say, no, that's not your land. He had to sue the heirs to get a warranty. Hey, your father gave me these lands. You must come and warranty. He then loses the case because he misspelled the land. And this was a technicality. If he had the money, he could buy another writ and sue, but just feel so bad because they're like, no, you're not unfree. This is probably your land, but you got one letter off in a time when spelling is not concrete. And people really gloss over this fact that misspelling something in a time when spelling is not set is just crazy. And the court does this. Like, no, you've misspelled that. Like, but nothing, the spelling's not set. When
that is wild. I think of all the spellings I've encountered, and, you know, trying to sound out absurd phonetic spellings of things. Yeah.
But I do have one final story I want to talk about. Is you probably read Elena MacOtar. She rented lands to a very powerful English lord called Edmund Le Baltier, and then kicked him off the lands shortly afterwards. And his English lord, he had to wait until he was appointed temporary chief justice of English Ireland to sue her in the chief justice court, which he was presiding over. There was nothing he could do to stop this Ost woman from whatever she wanted. She was like, I do what I want. And the only time he was able to sue her for kicking him off lands during his lease was when he was chief justice. He wasn't powerful enough on his own. He needed the full weight of the colony behind him to take on this one woman in Cashel. And so I'll end it there.
That's a great place to end, because it does bring us back around to the strategies of negotiation that people are employing, you know, regardless of to what degree they are or are not privileged within this legal system. They are, you know, employing every strategy they have at their disposal, and sometimes creating new ones to claim authority or to defend their position. And so I think that's a really great place to leave this. I know I've taken up a lot of your time, but before I let you go, I want to ask one more question, which is what you're working on now.
Oh yeah, right now I am working on people from the Low Countries who immigrated to England in the 12th century, and descendants of people who earlier immigrated, and what is their socio-legal status. And then after I've done with that study, I'm going to compare them to the colonial situation in English Ireland, how the Gaels were treated, because I think there's a very interesting thing going here. One, no one would ever have thought to compare Flemings and Brabanters to the Gaelic Irish. But the problem is English chroniclers in the 12th and 13th century say the same thing of these violent, inferior people. They're inferior to the English, but they're more violent and stronger than us. Like, wait, what's going on here? But you use the exact same words for these two different, very different situations. So I want to really dive into that and go, now why are they using, is there an influence going on here? I mean, they're not saying that about everyone else. I mean, everyone else is inferior because they're English and they think they're great, but they're not saying this exact inferior, but more violent than the English. So I want to really dive into that. But first I've got to establish a baseline of, well, how were people from Hainault and St. Paul and Brabant and Queens? Well, there's all these counties. People usually just say, oh, they're all Flemish. And it's like, well, they're not, but they're not. So that's what I'm currently working on, is separating out people from Boulogne and St. Paul from Flemings, from Hainault, from Brabanters.
That sounds like a great project and like a really interesting continuation of some of the themes from Beyond Exclusion. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Stephen. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
You're welcome.
Take care.